Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Marius Rhodes. Marius, how are you doing?
How's it, Nick? You're sounding not that energetic this afternoon.
Well, I mean, we'll get to that in a second. And of course, we're also joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
I'm okay. I think also a little low energy, but what can you do?
Indeed. So the big news that's just dropped in the past, I think, 20 minutes even, is that former president and deputy president F.W. de Klerk has died of a type of lung cancer at the age of, I think, 85. So, of course, this is a guy who played a very big role in South Africa's in the formation of South Africa's current makeup. Of course, he was the last apartheid era president. And he was also crucial to the negotiated process by which apartheid ended and the new South Africa began. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in, I can't remember what year it was, I think it was 1990 or 1991, somewhere around there.
It was 93, I think.
93. In cooperation, he also won it alongside Nelson Mandela. They shared it. And that was, I think, probably quite a high point of his career. And then he went on to serve in the Government of National Unity after 94 as one of the deputy presidents, because the NP had managed to get 20% of the vote, which was the threshold, I think, to get a deputy president. So very much an important figure in South African history, and one who makes people on both sides of the political spectrum get very upset. There's a sort of I don't know what to call it, an old-fashioned right-wing verkrumpter part of the country that sees him as someone who sold out to the ANC. And then, of course, there's people on the sort of EFF end of the spectrum who say that he's, you know, a monster and an evil apartheid apologist who needs to be damned forever in history. But I think all of us here probably share a much more nuanced view of the man. So I know our colleague Gabriel Krauser is actually very admiring of some of the steps he took to end apartheid and make the transition. So let me start with you, Maurice. What do you make of the life and times of F.W. de Klerk and his impact on South Africa?
Look, I mean, like all of us, he was a flawed person who wasn't a saint, but he also wasn't a demon. He was obviously a supporter of apartheid. He was a National Party politician. He played a big role in the cabinets of John Vorster and P.W. Botha. He became president in 1989. But he took steps that were very necessary at the time. Apartheid South Africa could probably have held out for another 10 or 15 years after 1990. But there would have been not much left of South Africa after that, and there would have been much more bloodshed and so on. So I think de Klerk did what needed to be done. I think something that's also forgotten is that he actually took the leap that P.W. Botha sort of tentatively was thinking of taking, but just didn't have he didn't have the cojones to do it in the mid-1980s. And de Klerk took the steps that he needed to do. There's maybe some criticisms you can point to him that he was, him and the National Party were maybe, you know, out-negotiated or out-thought during the negotiations with the ANC and others. But at the end of the day, we ended up with a very liberal constitution. You know, it was there obviously things that can be criticized about it, you know, certain things, but it's all very easy to say this, you know, 20 or 30 years after the fact, and this was a mistake and so on. So I think while the F.W. de Klerk can definitely be criticized for some things, I think his role, the role that he played in ending apartheid fairly peacefully, I mean, there's still a lot of people that die, you know, in the 1980s and up until 1994 as the country was changing and so on. I think overall he played an enormous role in South Africa. And I do think, maybe I'm wrong here, but I do think history will probably judge him kindly. And, you know, maybe there's probably a couple of mistakes he made post-1994. I think maybe the like, kind of ham-fisted way they tried to rebrand the National Party by calling it the New National Party. He probably made a mistake by going into the Government of National Unity maybe immediately after 1994. You know, maybe you should have carried on being the leader of the National Party for a bit longer, not letting somebody like Martinus van Schalkwyk take over in, I think, was 1997. So, yeah, overall, I think de Klerk, I think, you know, he's obviously a complex figure, but I think there's a lot that South Africans need to thank him for. But I think the next 2 or 3 weeks on social media are going to be hell. We're going to get right-wingers who tell us he sold us out and he was a terrible person in league with Satan. And at the same time, we're going to get, you know, EFF types who are going to tell us the exact same thing, that he was in league with Satan and basically South African Hitler and so on. So it's going to be a rough couple of weeks. But, yeah, condolences to, obviously, the Clark's family and his friends and so on, and anybody who worked with him and admired him.
You know, as someone who's very passionate about history, I often get very annoyed when people sort of are very vague about the details and the context of a time and then sort of just say, hindsight 2020, this guy was terrible and here's the reasons why. As though, you know, they wouldn't have done much worse in those exact circumstances themselves. And we were just saying before the show that that particular generation, the transition, you know, sort of Mandela, de Klerk, both sides, they obviously did a lot of things that we're quite critical of, as Anthea Jeffrey has chronicled in The People's War. But at the end of the day, you know, they produced a resolution which didn't result in an absolute tidal wave of bloodshed, which is what South Africa could always have turned into. Terence, what are your thoughts on the life of F.W. de Klerk?
Well, he was, I forget where I read this, but one commentator said of him that he was rather like a computer, that he was very logical in the way that he thought. And to the extent that his decisions had a moral content, they came from the fact that he realized that it was that apartheid was not workable. Once something was not workable, then to try and make it work became immoral. You know, he was able to take the steps that he could take because he had this particular pedigree and family background and you know, long history in the National Party. And of course, that is also why he evokes such criticism in certain quarters and such hatred. Look, I think that from a kind of political point of view, he believed that it was going to be possible to force a long-term power sharing agreement, probably for the, you know, at least a decade, probably longer. And if I remember the National Party's constitutional proposals in the early 90s, they're talking about a sort of Swiss model, a consociationalism, which was criticized by a lot of commentators at the time as being, you know, the Nats holding on to their privileges. Although there actually is a fairly respectable body of political theory that says that for a society with deep cleavages, that is not a bad thing to do. Instead, you know, what we ended up with was a system that that pushed majoritarianism and put all the incentives into fostering divisions, fostering political divisions. And, you know, and I think that the National Party by that stage had simply become ossified. It wasn't up to conducting much of a negotiation. And I think there was also a sense, probably in the early 90s, amongst many National Party politicians, and possibly also amongst Klerk himself, that, you know, for the first time, they were being welcomed and respected on the world stage. And I think that, you know, became very heady, and they were very, very keen to get an agreement. Yeah, you know, an interesting anecdote though, and I think this foreshadows the way a lot of opinion later went. When they received, when de Klerk and Mandela received the Peace Prize in Oslo, although the Nobel Committee treated them as equals, there was a big torchlight procession, you know, through the streets of Oslo by political parties and activist groups for Mandela, but very pointedly excluding de Klerk. You know, but at the end of the day, there are no angels and devils on earth. There are flawed people who make imperfect decisions.
I see one of our commenters here is referencing a debate he held with Nelson Mandela on national TV. And this is a point that that Gabriel always brings up, and I think he's right about it, which is there were some good moments in our political culture that I wish had continued onwards, such as having a proper televised debate between two of the main party candidates going into election. And we haven't seen that since. And one wonders what sort of John Steenhuisen versus Cyril Ramaphosa might be like, or you know, if you include Julius in that mix as well, might be quite interesting. Be even more fun if you put Herman Mashaba on as well.
Funny thing, in about 2009, I think it was 2010. I wrote a paper about South Africa's political culture, and I talked about that. That we have never seen since the 94 election, we've never seen party leaders go up against each other in that sort of debate. And there's a very simple reason for it. For the ANC to do that, to put their sort of key faces up for scrutiny, would be to acknowledge that they operate on the same plane as other political parties, rather than being a kind of natural leader of society. You know, you can send the deputy or the branch, you know, the treasurer of the local branch to go and talk to Helen Zille, but it is simply beneath the dignity of the president of the ANC to engage on that level with a mere political party. Interestingly, with what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, whether that sort of logic will still, I think the logic in their heads will still hold, but the thinking behind it is becoming increasingly less justifiable.
Indeed. And it would be very good if we saw a return of those so that we have, you know, people can take inspiration. It, you know, this is not a new thing to do in South African politics. Maurice, any final thoughts before we move on?
Not really. Like I say, I'm not looking forward to social media over the next couple of weeks, because we're going to get everybody who has 2020 vision and tell us what de Klerk should have done. And like I say, he was either this horrible sellout of the Afrikaner people, or he was basically, you know, evil incarnate who was basically, you know, built the apartheid system by himself and was, you know, directing Eugene de Kock personally on, you know, per personal hotline to Eugene de Kock and Fluck Blast and what have you. I mean, on that note, I'm sure FW de Klerk knew a bit more than he admitted to. I remember when the 2RC hearings were going on, FW de Klerk said, you know, like he didn't know about a lot of these death squads and so on. And somebody pointed out, look, if this is true, or he said that there's only a couple of conclusions he could come to. He's either lying or he's stupid. So that is one thing. But then at the same time, it was, you know, you also don't want to whitewash the guy, but also, like I say, he wasn't in charge of the Wehrmacht in 1943.
Right, I think it's difficult to find someone in the 90s period who doesn't have their hands covered in a bit of blood, except maybe the DP.
The ANC,
National Party.
Exactly. Stuff that happened in KwaZulu-Natal, stuff that happened in places like Quatro with the ANC, you know, and, you know, like, let's call it what it was. It was a war, and nobody in a war comes out with their hands clean or being squeaky clean. And also, a lot of people will tell you that FW de Klerk and, you know, other people, Constant Viljoen or PW Botha or whatever, you should have been on trial. We should have had Nuremberg style trials after the 1994, which is all well and good. But remember, the end of apartheid was a negotiated end. If MK cadres were marching down church streets, you know, and bashing down the gates of the union buildings with Soviet tanks, you know, and the SADF had been completely decimated in a war.
Well, if that had happened, we probably wouldn't have been a liberal democracy then.
No, exactly. Well, the Republic of South Africa probably wouldn't exist anymore either. But I mean, it was a negotiated transition, and, you know, some things had to, there were some things that weren't perfect, the various, you know, things that happened, the TRC, people getting amnesty and so on. But if we wanted to move forward as a democracy, I think sometimes you've got to take that kind of thing, you've got to take the rough with the smooth. There's also, I mean, there's also lots of people who feel that they didn't get justice for people who were murdered on various sides of the political aisle in the 1990s.
Yeah, no, that's always the case with these sort of political compromises, is you're never going to have a truly happy ending, because there's so much mess and so much leeway given to things.
The secret to a good compromise is that everybody's pissed off.
Yeah, no, that's probably true. Anyway, yeah, so condolences to F.W. de Klerk, and it is in some ways the end of an era. Of course, you know, Mandela died a few years ago, and now de Klerk's gone. That the leaders of that sort of transitionary period are now past us, and South Africa is in a very different place, and we must look to our current issues. Anyway, let us move on to our next topic today, and this is a story which is probably going to get a lot of traction on social media, especially among the more conspiratorial-minded, and not without some good reason. So the IEC has given the go-ahead for a vote recount in some Western Cape voting districts after there were claims that there were missing votes. So there have been several people on social media pointing out that there are weird anomalies in the results from particular voting districts, particularly in the Western Cape, but around the country. Voting stations where, for example, the DA, the ANC, and some of the other big parties got no votes at a ward level and then large numbers of votes at a proportional representation level, and that this may in fact end up changing the seat allocation in some municipalities by a small amount. Something to flag, because we're growing increasingly concerned with the credibility of the IEC. And while this stuff seems sort of too awkward and random and not obviously in anyone's favor, at least as far as I've seen, to suggest that it's outright cheating, this is exactly the kind of thing that can cause cheating to be undetected, is when the system is sloppy and messy like this. Terrence, what do you make of it?
It's interesting what you say about how sloppy and uncoordinated systems can let all sorts of funny things happen. There was an article in the BBC about 10 years ago about how to rig an election in various parts of the world. Sometimes you shoot the opposition. But I remember very distinctly, quite amusing, the Nigerian system was it's just so chaotic that no one can actually follow it. And yes, that is a problem. You know, even when people are being honest, the credibility suffers. And you need to see a few people start complaining, and you can throw the whole system into disarray and into a contest. Look, in a way, it's good that that there is recourse when something strange seems to happen with the results. I think we shouldn't ascribe to malice what can be explained through incompetence. You know, you remember that. These people are working very, very long days, and it's not beyond the reach of possibility that someone, you know, scribbles down numbers incorrectly. And if we can correct it, and you know, there's a trail of evidence, then that is well and good. I don't think even with the best will in the world, a country like South Africa is going to get a perfect election. I mean, you know, you even have disputes in America. If you remember the 2000 election. Something that just didn't leave the news headlines for like the next decade.
But it came down to what, 500 votes in Florida or something?
Something like that.
537, I think.
Yeah. So, Marius, what do you make of this? I think it's very good that there is a recount being held, because my experience of the IEC personally has been that generally they don't really act on a lot of complaints with an enormous amount of enthusiasm. So this at least seems to be a positive step towards this, although one wonders whether they should have picked this up very obviously themselves.
Yeah, I mean, some of the errors, just as an aside, anybody who's on Twitter should follow a guy called Michael Atkins. He's been doing a lot of this, looking at the various voting districts and flagging a lot of errors and so on. It seems that a lot of these are just like... basic human error. But then you also got to ask yourself, how has this been not noticed by anybody, none of the counting people doing the counting or the various polling agents, none of the party agents? Because as far as I understand, you'll probably be able to correct me, Nick, the IEC officials will say, okay, these are the final counts, and the various party agents will sign off on it and say, yes, we agree with this, or whatever the case
is. So If I may make a suggestion, and I don't have evidence for this, but I wouldn't be surprised if the error didn't come in at the level where the party agents have oversight, which is at the actual voting district itself, but that it might have been rather at the capturing center, because they take all of the results to the capturing center and then feed them in, and whether the mistake was made there. And that's actually the weak point in the system, as far as I understand, because as far as I know, it's not nearly as well watched as the local actual voting process is. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's where the error crept in.
Because I've definitely seen some things that are certainly human error. Saw a thing where in one of the voting districts, a party called the Democratic Liberal Congress, which is a breakaway from the Minority Front. I didn't even know the Minority Front was big enough to have breakaways. But anyway, they were given in of one voting station 1,800 votes, and the DA only had 4 votes. And looking at the rest of that ward, it didn't make sense that the Democratic Liberal Congress would get so much support. Also, looking historically, it didn't make sense. Also, the leader of the Cape Independence Party, Jack Miller, says he believes the reason why his party lost some votes is because their abbreviation was CAPE Exit, C-A-P Exit, on the ballot paper, and people capturing it didn't know that that votes for CAPE Exit had to go to the Cape Independence Party, which it's abbreviation you'd think would be CRP. So these are obviously just a human error. But I mean, as Terence also points out, these people have been working probably on the go for more than 24 hours. So this kind of thing is going to happen. And look, I don't think it's rigged, because otherwise, if it was rigged, then the ANC, they were very competent in their rigging, because normally when elections get rigged, the governing party gets 80% of the vote. If this was rigged, the ANC was very clever to get themselves only 45%. And to make sure that they lost quite a lot of places across the country. So, but this is obviously something to flag. And, you know, the IEC is definitely an institution that needs to be very strong in South Africa. If we get to a point where people are seriously skeptical of election results, that is a big problem. I mean, that is a key of democracy, where the losers accept the result and accept that they've lost and, you know, carry on, let the winners, you know, get on the business of governing. If we get to a point where people are skeptical of the results and won't accept, you know, election results, then we're going to be going down a very dark path. So we need to make sure the IEC is as strong as possible, and that various agents that work around the country as IEC officials are well-trained and are doing a proper job.
Yeah, I was talking the other day about this to someone, about how I think actually there is a zone, though, particularly in close elections, as does happen in some of these wards, where sort of malice and incompetence bleed into each other. So I'll give you an example. Let's say that there's special votes, and the special votes tend to be in favor of one party, and the IEC officials tend to be in favor of the other party, and they don't really get the logistics sorted out for driving to those special votes. That's, you know, usually old people who can't actually go to the voting station. And then instead of making a plan, they sort of just say, you know, those are going to be for the other side anyway, so we're not going to bother because we didn't get it sorted out in time. I wouldn't be surprised if at least a little bit of that happened. And in some of these very close elections, it can actually make a difference. And I wouldn't be surprised if there has been at least some meaningful cheating in South Africa so far. But so far, not enough to completely steal an election. Terence, any final thoughts on this?
Well, I suppose just to refer back to 1994, that as the results trickled in, I understand that IEC headquarters, the enthusiasm for making sure these were accurate began to decline very, very rapidly. It was about, we have to kind of just get this election done. And I think Judge Kriechler said something about this is about reconciling the country, not reconciling ballots. And I also heard a story that the DP was considered taking it to court. And one of their counselors said, "We can't do this." And, "Why, are you afraid we'll lose?" "No, I'm afraid we'll win."
Interesting. That's the whole can of worms that we really don't have the time or expertise to properly open up. But the things that you can say about the 94 election was, shall we say, not our best run election by any means. And that's even compared to some of the not great elections in the last two.
But to be fair, I mean, that election was run without a voter's roll and all kinds of things.
Yeah, which in hindsight, I think is a bit of a disaster, but whatever.
Yeah.
Hindsight 2020, et cetera,
Exactly. Easy for us to sit here in 2021 and
look, point out. We got an election. Live with it.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so let's move on now to our next story. And Terence, this is some concerns that you have relating to the firearms legislation, which we have been campaigning against. Do you just want to quickly flag what those concerns are?
Yeah, we are putting out these civilian secretary for policing was holding a webinar, which I understand was meant to be their public participation on the Firearms Control Amendments Act. Now, for those not familiar, this not only eliminates the possibility of owning a firearm for self-defense, but also seems to eliminate the use of a firearm in self-defense. It would also outlaw firearm collecting, which has very big heritage implications. Firearms, by the way, are listed as a heritage item in the Heritage Resources Act. And it would also severely constrict hunting and sport shooting. Look, you know, this is kind of, I think, if not a gun-free society, this is very much on the way to one, at least gun-free in the sense that civilian gun ownership would be imperiled. The research and analysis, the socioeconomic impact document that was produced was deficient, very much so. In fact, I've said it's somewhere between a joke and an insult. For instance, banning collectors was justified on the basis that there is a perception that collectors are collecting all these lethal weapons that are going to be used to go and do all sorts of horrible things. I'm not joking. Yeah, go and look it up for yourself. Anyway, so this webinar was going to take place over 2 days, and I think this was going to then tick the public participation box. But here's the funny thing. We were not invited to it, despite the fact that we had made a submission, despite the fact that we had written about it, we had sent in signatures in opposition. We heard about it through someone else, and we were sent notification by this private party on last Saturday. Now, this workshop was scheduled for today and tomorrow. To take 2 days out of your schedule is difficult for anyone. To do it with that sort of notice is ridiculous. And it appears that we actually got wind of it quite rapidly after it was announced. It seems a lot of stakeholders were not invited, not necessarily all on, let's say, the pro-gun side. And also, this is during a week of load shedding. So it's all going to be virtual, but you'll just be bobbed in and out of it because you won't be able to be online. So there was an outcry of people saying this is just procedurally rubbish. I mean, I personally wrote a letter and I said, you know, thank you very much for accepting our approach to attend, but you know, this is just logistically you can't do this. And they backed off now and they said they'll organize a better one later. Be very, very careful, you know. These games are not just about the big ideas or the end result, but about the procedure they follow. And this, I think, is as hazardous to people who are supportive of the bill's objectives as those who are opposed to this. Because what this seems to be doing is tilting the process in such a way that you get to do what you need to do legally, at least nominally do it. And, you know, then you get to do what you intended to do all along.
Exactly. All right. Maurice, do you have anything to add to that before we close up today?
No, I'm not. I'll leave the gun stuff to our resident firearms experts here, Mr. Corrigan and Mr. Lorimer. I'm a pacifist, so although I don't have any objection to somebody else owning a gun, I don't think I would like to.
Fair enough. Right. So one more thing that we don't really have time to talk about today is in fact, Remembrance Day. That is on the anniversary of the end of the First World War, 11th of November. It's a day that South Africa doesn't celebrate, I think, as well as it should, considering the fact that South Africa did actually have a significant, particularly given our size, role in both the First and Second World Wars, in which we were both, I think, on the right side of history, to use a not very good phrase. And I'd encourage you all to read about South Africa's exploits in those conflicts and remember those who fought, particularly against the tyranny of fascist Italy and Nazism in the Second World War. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today and indeed for the week. We will be back next week. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening and watching. We hope you enjoyed the show and we will see you next week with the Daily Friend Show. Have a great weekend, everyone.